KUOW podcasts are made possible by listener support. Become a new or renewing member today at KUOW.org.
Most people who know me know I'm a pretty friendly guy. And I like a good party.
And I will faithfully discharge the duties
of governor of the state of Washington.
Of governor of the state of Washington.
Woo! My cocktail, so to speak, was only EPO, but not a lot. Transfusions and testosterone.
That was Lance Armstrong talking about his drug cocktail, Governor Inslee being inaugurated, and President Obama telling us he likes to party. Some of the stories were taken up this hour on weekday with Joni Balter, with Eli Sanders, with Knute Berger. You know, a few weeks ago, Skip hurt his back, and so he had to stand in order to do the show. I'm not sure if his back still hurts, but he stands, and so he lords it over us.
He's
a little bit.
Over every
and it makes us a little nervous.
Yeah, I like to see you all quaking in your boots.
He's got three dictionaries and an encyclopedia holding up the microphone. Yep.
Hey, I have to stand to be as tall as you guys. So.
There is that.
So we'll keep that in mind as we discuss. You know, I know it's not necessarily part of our conversation, but two things were of the biggest news this week, really, right? One was, what was Lance Armstrong going to say? And eventually, what did he say? And the other one was Teo. We're going to get to those two things. You guys hold that for a moment.
Oh, well.
I'm just teasing you with that.
Oh.
Because I did want to bring Nick Bond in because I went long with David Alan Greer. Because, Nick, you're funny. But, you know, how often do I get to talk to a guy who got to be on Broadway and do the two snaps and a wave?
Well, you
in
got
living
a point
color.
There. Yeah, no problem.
I appreciate you being so flexible with us, because I was struck by the fact that we're gonna make a record. Are we gonna hit the record of dry days for this time of year?
Well, probably not. It's been 7 days and counting. It was Thursday, the 10th. We got our last rain, and it looks like it's probably gonna stay dry until Tuesday night, more likely Wednesday morning, and so it's probably going to be more like 12 days. The longest stretch that we've had in January was 15 days back in January 1963, but five of those days actually included trace amounts of and twice snow, and so this is a pretty long stretch. We've had 13-day stretches a couple of times before and a couple of times 12 days, but still unusual.
You think, oh, by the way, Nick Bond is the Washington State climatologist. I should introduce you. I apologize. I just started asking you questions. And he joins us every Friday to give us a little bit of weather and a little bit of the facts behind the weather. You expect that we'll see a wetter pattern coming in pretty soon here on the west side?
Well, yeah. Our ridge will break down. And so, again, kind of more typical weather in the midweek. And then probably another system on Friday. After that, kind of our future is up in the air, pun intended, right? The models are wildly inconsistent. Some have it just a kind of a typical weather pattern with the lowland rain, mountain snow, and a system every couple of days. Others are kind of a cool but not frigid pattern with pretty low snow levels. But some of the others, and disquieting ones, are kind of building a big ridge over us and just to the west, and a return of more very quiet weather with fog and cold nights and nasty air quality and all that. So it's the crystal ball is very murky out there.
I know this is tough, but what does it mean that these are such different models? Is it because something else is happening that's very confusing, or is it a confusing La Niña El Niño pattern? What's going on?
No, it's more we just sometimes get into weather patterns that are inherently less predictable than other ones. And what's a good thing is that we have multiple models and there's runs made all the time, and so we can see how consistent they are versus inconsistent. And so at times we have a pretty good idea of what's going to be happening in the next week or even 2 weeks. In other times we can't look much into the future, and this is one of those times.
So what do you all right, so we'll just do the next few days. What's your your forecast?
It's going to be more of the same today. You know, the fog lingering for most of the day. We might get some brightening in the afternoon, but it's going to be kind of a dank day. Saturday and Sunday, probably more the same. On Sunday, maybe rather than fog, a little bit, just low clouds. And Monday, actually, there's a better chance of some afternoon sunshine. But it's going to continue to be chilly nights, especially in the South Sound, and kind of, again, poor air quality until we finally get some rain in here midweek.
All right. All right, Mr. Bond, I appreciate you talking to us. Appreciate your flexibility.
My pleasure.
Nick Bond is the Washington State climatologist. He works at the Joint Institute for the Study of Atmosphere and Ocean. He joins us with the weather outlook for the rest of the day and the weekend on Fridays. Knute Berger is the Mossback columnist at Crosscut.com, author of Pugetopolis. Joni Balter is assistant political editor for the Seattle Times. Eli Sanders, associate editor at The Stranger. So which story did you enjoy more, Lance Armstrong or Tao?
Well, I think you missed the bigger story, which, of course, was the president admitting that his kids don't like to hang out with him anymore and that some Republicans should come on over and play cards.
That's exactly right.
Just
he did say that. He likes a good party, but he's a little lonely.
I don't think the Republicans are going to be taking him up on that. Doesn't seem like it.
Especially the cards. You know?
You don't think they'll be playing cards with him?
That's just my guess. I enjoyed the football player story, and I'm hesitant.
Teos?
Yes, I'm hesitant to say.
How do you say his name? Monte Teo. Is that how you say it? Come on, somebody. Come on.
I know there are experts.
I'll leave it to the experts. I thought it was fascinating in part because it's a window onto, the downside of our interconnectedness and the amount of time we spend in virtual space and the amount of credence we give to people's virtual representations of themselves. It's not totally clear what was going on between the football player and his virtual girlfriend, who was virtual in more ways than just the usual way. But
what does that mean?
It means she didn't exist.
She didn't exist at all. She was not just virtual.
Oh,
she
no,
was
virtual
completely
speech.
Virtual.
Oh, the speech was virtual. She was virtual. I see.
Okay. Yeah.
Levels of virtual.
And the weirdness, if this was a genuine relationship that he thought he was having, the weirdness of his willingness to have a relationship that did not exist in physical space, as far as I can tell. I mean, it's really sad. That's not a real relationship, at least by my definition. There's the other possibility that, you know, this was part of a very elaborate hoax that he was part of perpetrating in order to get himself sympathy. All of it.
None of it making sense to us.
No, but it connects back maybe directly, maybe indirectly. We have to see how this plays out. But to a really interesting story that Siena Madrid did in The Stranger a little while ago about internet Munchausens. It's sort of a new pathology that has been given a new name by a psychiatrist who's been studying it, and a new kind of vector because of the internet. You know, Munchausen's being the seeking of attention in the physical world by faking illnesses. And it's made harder to do because you have to actually fool a doctor in physical space often to get, you know, the highest level of reward for your Munchausen's. But but internet Munchausen's, which is Siena looked at, and you can just search for internet Munchausen's and The Stranger and you'll get this story. It's really interesting. It is a real and really horrible thing for a lot of people who have been going online to support groups, say, for cancer. You know, people who actually have cancer and are interacting online because they're feeling isolated with people in cancer support groups. And then find, you know, down the road that one or even several, in some cases, of these people are faking it just to get attention online because it's easier than faking it in the real world.
Man.
So the sense is that the internet has lowered the barrier to acting out on a Munchausen-like impulse and what to do about that.
Your back really does hurt, right?
Oh sure.
That's right.
That's a fascinating notion that we're pursuing this level of attention and need.
Well, what about carrying on a relationship like that and talking about it in the real world when, in fact, you don't even know. You've seen, I guess, phony pictures, but you've never met this person. What does it say about us, a generation, a communication format that allows us to have, you know, just make things up in our mind and go along?
Well, if you can have Facebook friends, you could have Facebook girlfriends, I guess. I mean, you know, the whole notion of part of it is the ease with which you can enter and exit relationships. There's something kind of pathologically satisfying about being able to have kind of faux intimacy and then end it. You know, you can just log off or you can just go to another chat room or, you know, whatever it is. So and we live in a culture where the changing of one's identity and persona, we pick them up and put them down anyway, even without the Internet. We're kind of a country of people who reinvent themselves constantly. I want to tie this to the story I was more interested in, which was the Lance Armstrong deal. Here's a guy who's not a virtual fraud, but a real world fraud. You know, somebody whose entire story of sort of recovery and redemption and his athleticism and the thing was basically fabricated. I mean, all predicated on an elaborate scheme of drugs and deception and lawsuits and intimidation. I mean, it's the talk about, I mean, it was sort of Lance Armstrong, all-American boy, and then you turn out that the flip side is really, really ugly.
And an old story, you know, in a way that the hero having a dark side and a whole lot of bullying, basically, as I think he admitted to Oprah, that was...
Did he admit that he bullied? That was the part I wasn't clear of.
I don't think he has yet.
Yeah.
That's part two.
Yeah, maybe that's.
I thought I read that. Well,
I'll check again. I thought he stepped away from that, you know, that he had intimidated people. I think
he did say that he was a bully.
Well, there
he did refer to himself, but he didn't go into the specifics.
Anyway, there are plenty of people
done.
Who have been on, you know, the end of what they've described as intimidation from Lance or his people. And so, you know, it's just classic, and you run into characters like this all the time, people who are, you know, beloved and cultivate this wonderful image of themselves and are kind of saintly in people's eyes and behind the scenes are awful human beings who, you know, defend their perch through bullying and manipulation and intimidation.
But the interesting thing with him is that it's not like he's a great athlete who's also a jerk. It calls in the whole fraud is... the great athlete part. You know, the fact that he was using elaborate means to cheat to gain the very thing. I thought it was interesting. The Washington Post has their the truth teller or what you know, the column where they determine whether a political statement is fact or fiction. And if it's fiction, they give out certain number of Pinocchios. This is the Kessler thing. And he gave Lance Armstrong, he analyzed the interview and in his career. And usually he gives four Pinocchios. In Lance Armstrong's case, he gave 28 Pinocchios.
He just ran out of Pinocchios.
Four for each Tour de France victory.
Oh, that's right. That's right.
You are right. I mean, he is talking about his bullying in that interview. He doesn't like... embrace it, I guess. You know, in the end he says, you know, I'll do everything I can to survive. I took it all into cycling, win at all costs. I wasn't a bully before cycling, but then he said he had to do anything to win. I guess the connection for me is that it's still a question of what he's actually saying, admitting to, you know.
He's probably still going as far as he can right now
emotionally,
you know? Yeah, I mean, he's,
I guess,
this is
legally too.
Well, there will be that as well. You know, both these cases are interesting to me in a way about how people set up these ideals of themselves, and then the rest of us want to believe all this. We wanted to believe that a guy could beat testicular cancer and then come back and do the unthinkable, you know, all these Tour de France. And he even said in one of the interviews, Lance Armstrong, that it's probably because he went after the last Tour de France title. He wouldn't have gotten caught otherwise, because that's what brought so much to life. I just think there's this, we really, really have our own not responsibility that we didn't do the lying, but we do want to believe these stories as well. Just as like something I've always thought, and Facebook set up the name that the people that you're in contact with on Facebook are your friends. But what I've always said is ask one of these friends to help you move this weekend, and you'll find out all about that.
But I think
it's not a bad idea.
Joni, I think you're right about that, too. I mean, it's like they say with a good con game,
yeah.
You know, is you tell somebody what they want to hear. You tell somebody the story that they want to believe,
yes.
About the lost mine or the $1 million you have in the bank that they can help you get out. Whatever it is, you appeal to that. And I think the cancer recovery story in the Tao case, people have been criticizing the media for not investigating the story about his girlfriend sooner and looking at that. And partly it was because people liked the storyline that was coming out. It was very appealing to the media, that putting, you know, those human face on athletic stars. You see that during the Olympics too. People don't they're not so much interested in the actual competition. They want the backstory.
Yes.
Two emails just on this. Jennifer writes, 4% of our society, 1 in 25, are sociopaths, according to Martha Stout, Harvard psychologist. A sociopath is someone who does not have a conscience, no feelings of guilt or remorse, no struggles with shame, no sense of concern for the well-being of others. Sociopaths play by different rules. She's talking about Lance Armstrong there.
She's talking about Congress.
and Gerald says, did he really have cancer, or is that a fraud also? Medical Munchausen. All right. We'll talk about some Congress and some legislature. We'll take a break. This is Weekday.
I'm Bernard Ouellette. There's still a lot of news to talk about. We'll get right back to the gang here in a minute. First, let's talk about the weather for a second. It's 37 in Seattle with a predicted high today of 40. Mostly cloudy with fog through much of the day. Pretty much the same thing tomorrow.
When the explosions killed the university students in Aleppo this week, the Syrian photographer Issa Touma said he turned away from the news.
I didn't want to see more because it's enough to see after all this month, blood every second.
Coming up in the next edition of the story, how it is that people in Aleppo are getting by after months at the center of the fighting.
That's this afternoon at 2 on KUOW's second program service, KUOW2. Learn more at KUOW2.org.
Support for KUOW comes from the business group at Ryan, Swanson & Cleveland, lawyers in Seattle since 1897. Online at ryanswansonlaw.com.
It's 1022, KUOW 94.9 Seattle.
We are looking at the news this week with this Knut Berger, Eli Sanders, Joni Balter. But you were bringing up the Teddy Roosevelt case, and I'm going to look it up because you told me to confirm it, but I'm sure
you're right. But I think I have it right. I think for Teddy Roosevelt, there was this incredible tragedy. Oh, I think he lost his wife and his mother the same day. I want to get this right. In the same 24-hour period. And so this back-to-back notion is pretty amazing. It's pretty amazing, and it makes people feel so badly for you in the case of the... Somebody help me. Monty Teo. Yeah. So anyway, I just think that so if he really believed that.
Well, the internet says it's true.
Well, there you go. Well, that makes it true. Be.
History.com. On this day in February 14th, 1884, future President Theodore Roosevelt's wife and mother die only hours apart.
Right. And so what about that story? And what about, you know, that was they had actual bodies there in that case. So this one is so different. And what is the role of the press here? Anybody want to call Stanford University and see if there's a student there?
Yeah, I mean,
or not there? Don't you think they know which students died?
Yeah, you don't want to. I mean, part of you, wants to resist the point where when somebody says something, "Oh, my girlfriend died," and somebody says, "Show us the body," you know,
that's pretty crude.
But Jack Schaefer had a great column about this. He's a media columnist for Reuters now, and he was talking about how reporters themselves want to believe these stories, and heartstrings are pulled, and they become less skeptical than they ought to be. His advice at the end of the column to reporters was, if you feel your heartstrings being pulled, rip your heart out and stomp it on the floor, and then go do your job.
You know,
don't get caught up in it.
I didn't read this column, and I don't know if he mentioned this, but Jack Schaefer and I both tangled with a similar story here in Washington State, where there was a quote-unquote internet entrepreneur who had promised millions to the University of Washington Poetry Program. And Chuck Schaefer was then at Slate, and they had written about him in a way that turned out to be too credulous, and other places had too. And he turned out to not have the money that he said he had. He turned out to not be who he said he was. And I, since you brought up Jack Schaefer, I just remember a lot of emailing back and forth with him about this then. But it was the same type of thing. People wanted to believe that at the height of the dot-com boom, someone would take some of this money that was just being churned up so easily for tech stuff and redirect it to the humanities and to the least funded of all the humanities, poetry. And so no one really asked him too many questions. It was a story that they just loved so much they wanted it to be true. And then it turned out to be completely false. And Jack had to rip out his heart and stomp on it and stomp on this guy. His name was Ravi Desai. And I wrote about it, too. This was actually a long time ago. I wrote about it for the Seattle Times. So a very long time ago. But the other piece of these frauds and unmaskings, I think Joni's totally right about this.
How often do you say Joni's totally right? Just out of curiosity.
Yeah, get that clip.
You should have a little bell that dings every time.
I think it's interesting it went in the same paragraph with I worked for the Seattle Times.
I did.
Every time.
Disgruntled ex-employee.
Every time a bell rings.
I'm not disgruntled. I'm proud of that story.
No, it was good.
I mean, I ended up unmasking him is the end of the story, and I did that in the Seattle Times. But so... there's the desire to believe that enables these frauds, but then, you know, there's a kind of a direct correlation between the elaborateness and the boldness of the fraud and the absolute fury on the part of people who have been hoaxed when it's unmasked.
I have a question for all of you. Do any of you know anybody who has no other nice way to put this, an imaginary friend or girlfriend, not necessarily virtual, but just talks about somebody who you've never met or they've never met for that matter?
I don't think so.
Just asking. Just checking.
Do you?
Perhaps.
Really?
All right. Like Harvey the rabbit, you mean?
Very much, very rabbit-like.
I mean, I think, you know, the emailer a minute ago put his or her finger on something. I think we're just learning what all these personality styles, I think you could say, to put it nicely, but, you know, pathological lying, which Joni's talking about, sociopathic behavior, psychopathic behavior, how all of these relate it to the internet in and are amplified and enabled by the internet in ways that we're just learning to deal with.
And make our jobs so much harder. I mean, remember, I got hoaxed by a website that was purported to be from Shell about their drilling, but was actually a Greenpiece and hoaxed satire.
That was a deliberate political stunt.
Right.
That's
But I read the, you know, it looked like the Shell site, but also it had something in it that I was incredulous it would be there. It was just enough, right? And so I said, wow, Shell is really saying this. So I read it. Of course, that was their effort. That was their goal. And the internet makes that so much
more easy.
Does
that make you want to go on Barbara Wawa?
Yeah. It makes me makes me have to check everything five times instead of, you know, take anything, right, as we should. And it makes our jobs harder and, I guess, more serious in that sense, huh?
And more important, I mean, maybe this is also, although it's become, at least in the case of the football player, a moment for everyone to point at the legacy media and say how bad they screwed up and how much they enabled this too. But it's a reminder that whether it's legacy media or new media, we need someone out there who's paid to fact check things and who has time to. And, you know, I think some of this may be connected to the rickety business model that so much of the legacy media is operating under. The people who used to have a lot of time to fact check all of these things and take a long pause before writing about some of this stuff no longer have as much time.
I don't know that it would have made a difference in this case, but when I was doing research on the Space Needle book, I was spending a lot of time in the Seattle newspapers of the 1960s. And, you know, when they used to mention people in the paper, they always included your address.
Oh, really? Boy.
You know, if you were mentioned, I mean, it didn't matter whether it was a society page or the the news page or the arts page, you know, it would say, you know, Joni Balter, blah, 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 you know, Avenue East or whatever it was. And there's this way in which, like now we all sort of can take advantage of certain kinds of, I mean, we're sort of in a surveillance society, but we also are able to create false identities and whatnot very easily with the internet and different kinds of capabilities. It's easier to fake driver's licenses. I mean, you know, all that kind of stuff. But it's interesting because kind of in the olden days, there was a kind of accountability that you don't have, which was if you were subject of a news story, everyone knew where to find you. But it wasn't that you were necessarily going to be stalked.
Well, what about aggregating? Aggregating just adds to all of this because once something is a story living somewhere on someone's site, there's this tendency to say, well, I was just picking up link. I was just picking up their story. And there's not fresh reporting that goes. Sometimes there is, but often there is not. Fresh reporting that goes, hey, where'd this young lady go to school? Why don't I call them? Or why don't I call and push on this a little bit more with Monty, whose name I can't say.
Yeah.
But go ahead.
But if somebody's pushing the love story plot, there's just less of most people's skepticism.
Assume you know who you're dating. They do assume you know who you're dating.
Exactly.
There's sort of
there's
an assumption.
Just your skepticism
all right, so here, but that was Lance Armstrong, too, and that was his story. Here's Laura. She says, I'm an amateur road racer, heavily into cycling, both my own and training with professionals. It's been known among cyclists that Armstrong and nearly everyone else was doping. Cycling, like most sports, makes use of performance-enhancing drugs. Basically, we're not surprised at this. That said, you could pump me full of EPO and every other drug, and I still would not be able to compete at that level. Even amongst the women, so professional cycling, she's making the point, is a difficult sport, the most difficult sport in the world. Doesn't make it right, but an explanation. I mean, so we have these kind of complicated realities because we are, so much is exposed, so much is explained, and so many people can comment.
That's a really important and interesting wrinkle that even without the EPO or EPO, I'm not sure how you say it.
That one might be EPO.
EPO. Armstrong was an incredible athlete. And like she's saying, could outrace, you know, 99% of cyclists out there, but I guess felt he needed that little extra push to outrace.
To win all those.
Yeah. But I agree. That's an interesting wrinkle. But it ends up, you know, to the public, we believe that he was who he became through the use of the EPO, and it ends up invalidating the entire thing, I think, for the general public just because of the falsehood.
So the next person who wins the Tour de France, are we going to buy it? Are we going to just say...
That sport is tainted for a long time. Mm-hmm. I mean, wasn't there Greg LeMond and some other former cyclists are trying to create a new idea behind the sport so they can come clean?
But. Well, clearly, it seems like the times will back up a little bit, the final numbers of your time spent completing this course will certainly be less. But if still, if the next winner, what are we going to do about that?
All of this is around the generation of the brand, Josh says. Brand Obama, brand Taos, brand Armstrong, before and after. Whether you're a bad boy, girl, brand Kim Kardashian, who becomes popular because of the actions they take, it's all about the branding. I mean, and that branding influences...
The branding is part of the wanna believe story.
Yeah.
They're very connected, very connected.
Well, and it's part of the incentive for the person who's turned their selfhood into a marketable brand, which must be a head trip. It's part of their incentive to keep the falsehood going because, you know, every brand kind of embellishes on what the product actually is. And it's because of the financial reward. And so, for Armstrong or anyone else doing this, that there becomes this, I think, perverse incentive to be not who you are.
Well, as Mark says in the Lake City, he writes, the famous old newshound adage on NPR this morning, as a matter of fact, if your mother says she loves you, make sure you get a second source.
Second opinion.
Yeah. All right. Well, while President Obama was waxing sad about his fate, also this week, Jay Inslee was inaugurated. Anything? Did you learn anything from the Inslee inauguration, some of the things he said coming out of the gate?
My favorite part of watching an inauguration speech is, you know, some of the delivery and all that. But I really like to watch who stands up and claps and who sits there looking like they just, you know, ate a lemon or something. I always think that's fun to watch. His speech was short on specifics, except for he was, you know, pretty heavily into climate change. innovation, which, if you remember, one of his ads during campaign, a little light went off with Bing, you know, innovation. He was light on tax talk, although that came up the next day. And he did mention gun control, which is an interesting development for him because, remember, he was a congressman first from Eastern Washington. So he had to always walk that very careful line on that one. So, that, you know, all of that. You know, more news came out of the news conference, which was yesterday, about how he would interpret his absolutely, let me see if I can say this right, no new taxes.
Would you explain how he interpreted that?
Well, he interpreted that by saying that extending taxes that were due to expire, and he's referring to a business and occupation tax and a beer tax, that extending those for something like $683 million gain for the budget is not the same as raising the tax. So we should have that conversation. Is extending a tax that's due to expire raising it or just holding it on longer? What do you think?
Well, how did the Republicans decide that when they went over the fiscal cliff? They were voting for tax cuts, right, because they voted the next day. So is there – how do you take Jay Inslee's argument?
What's that? Well, I think Grover Norquist said it wasn't raising taxes, didn't he? For the Republicans, yeah.
So you can argue
that both ways. But I thought that was really interesting, too. I mean, we've all been waiting for the wiggle. We've all been waiting for the tax wiggle. And it finally came in a very kind of subtle form. He said, I'm not saying I support this, but what do you think of this? But I would look at it this way. And, of course, it's one of the things that Gregoire was recommending as she went out the door, which was – and, you know, she's absolutely right. You know, we need more money. You know, the other thing interesting I thought was the comment in the inaugural about the disruptive change. You know, and of course Inslee is in this interesting position of being, you know, part of the party that's been in power for so long, yet wanting to be a change agent. And how do you reconcile that? And he has enough kind of outsider credit. He is appointing business people who are not Olympia insiders to lead major departments, Department of Information Services and other kinds of things. He is bringing in new people. And the idea is that in order to fulfill his vision, things do have to change, and they have to change. Now, whether you can accomplish that, that's a whole other, you know, other thing. But he seems to be very much doing what he has promised to do in terms of bringing in new blood and being committed to kind of changing business as usual, getting innovative thinking that way.
Just to answer your question, I think we should apply some of the lessons from the last conversation to the political conversation. And, you know, Inslee can brand himself however he wants, this change agent, disruptive change agent. The devil will be in the details, and we should watch what he does more than what he says. So the tax wiggle is interesting, and it is important. And as Knut said, Gregoire has made very clear you cannot – she tried for 8 years. You can't fix this state's budget problems without – serious revenue. And so Inslee is now saying, well, continuing a tax increase is not the same as instituting a tax increase. I think that's a fair argument. And the other moment...
Continuing a tax is not the same as instituting a tax increase.
Well, but this tax, when it was instituted, was an increase.
Right.
But it's not a new increase to just continue the
right.
old increase.
Right.
Which I think actually is... It makes sense.
It's status quo.
The other moment of truth for him will be when he presents his budget. And that will be coming soon. And that's another moment where you can look and see, okay, is this change? Or is this more the same? Is this going backward?
The one thing I forgot to mention in the inaugural speech, Jay Inslee did talk about the Reproductive Parity Act.
I forgot about that. That's a good example.
That's an example where he was specific on that. He said, let's do this. And reproductive parity means if an insurer, and the ones in Washington do this, cover maternity care, they also have to include abortions in there. And I think this is possible that he felt that he had cover because a Republican, a moderate Republican senator from Mercer Island, Steve Litzow, is the co-sponsor of that, along with another moderate, a Democrat, Steve Hobbs, who introduced that earlier in the week or last week, one of those, and sort of said, you know, it's all about the budget, but here's something that's not all about the budget.
We see, now this is an example, Randy Becker, who I talked to and we ran that part of the interview, said that it seemed to me, she said, she supported that. But I realized in listening to that interview again, there was a little bit of wiggle room there.
Well, I didn't hear your interview, but there's no maybe about Steve Litzau since he's sponsored.
Well, but Richard DeBolt, the House leader in the Times,
was a little unhappy with that.
Did not like what he heard.
He didn't like the idea, and yeah, he was quoted in our story. He didn't like the idea of politicizing an inaugural speech. In other words, this is a polarizing issue for some folks down there, and he didn't like having that in the inaugural speech. An inaugural speech, to hear him talk, supposed to be unifying things we can all agree on, like jobs and economic, you know, go ahead is and education. So those are like things we don't fight over, but we do fight over reproductive
criticisms that the president, I'm sure, will get with his gun legislation at his State of the Union.
Oh, absolutely.
Anything else on Inslee,
well,
folks want to mention?
You were mentioning the legislators and their stance on reproductive parity, and I think what you're seeing is it's the beginning of the legislative session. Everyone is setting up their goals, but also drawing their little escape hatches, you know, and that's where you're noticing the wiggle room. That might be the escape hatch that someone runs through later on. But the Republican support for reproductive parity may also be connected to something we talked about a bit in the aftermath of the election, which is that Republicans in the state know they need to find a few ways to become more mainstream on social issues. And here's one, potentially, if they can muster the will to do it.
That seems right. All right, we'll take a break. Let's come back and talk about the mayor's race and gun control. This is Weekday.
In other news, stink bugs are back. Where did they go and why have they returned? We'll find out today on KUOW's Afternoon News Magazine from 3 to 7 p.m. 36 degrees in Seattle, heading towards a high today of 40. Mostly cloudy with fog through much of the day.
I'm Bob Garfield on this week's On the Media. One New York City reporter's beat is to tell the story behind every juvenile killed by gun violence. The part we don't see on the news.
You see the picture of the yellow police tape. You see that the kid had a record or was shot in the head or was part of a gang. What aren't they saying?
Don't miss this week's On the Media from WNYC.
Sunday night at 6 on KUOW 94.9 Seattle.
KUOW and Arts West present Shirley Valentine, a one-woman comedy about an unhappy middle-aged Liverpool housewife who sets off to Greece in search of her own life and soul, January 23rd through February 16th at Arts West Playhouse in West Seattle. Learn more on the events page at kuow.org.
Hey, we're in Radioactive today. Down in the studio, we'll do it all day. We're voicing, recording, and editing all. We still gotta go.
Feeling the beat? Apply to Radioactive, KUOW's free storytelling workshop. Youth ages 16 to 18 can apply at kuow.org/radioactive.
Don't forget, applications are due Monday, January 21st for the Radioactive Spring 2013 After School Workshop. Look, you might become a journalist, and you'll have to, check twice if your mother loves you or not. But there's Amina Alsadi working with us as a producer, started in a high school program. So dreams can happen. So check out the Radioactive application at kuow.org. We'd like to see you as part of this event. Or if your children are in school, tell them. And if you're listening and you have a 16 to 18-year-old, tell them to become a part of it. We're reviewing the news of the week with Knute Berger, with Joni Balter, with Eli Sanders, with your emails. All right, so we have another couple of candidates for running for mayor of Seattle. So we have David Ishii, a self-described poet and artist. He filed paperwork Wednesday, but he is not the David
bookseller
Ishii bookseller
that people might recognize.
Okay.
From.
Right. He's the seventh person to announce his candidacy. And earlier in the week, Bruce Harrell, Seattle City Council member, announced his candidacy. He said that Mayor McGinn's style was ineffective. That's one of the reasons he's running. Where are we now?
Well, there was no surprise that Bruce Harrell announced. He'd been talking about it for some time. It is a little bit unusual to have, we have two city council members and one former city council member in this race. That's a lot of people, as we've talked over the weeks, dividing 100%. And what happens when you get this fragmented or this many people is that it's very hard to tell which group is going to go with which candidate, especially this early on. And so, yeah, it's pretty busy race. Pretty busy race. Very interesting. About 10 minutes after Bruce Harrell announced, there was a post. Remind me where, but there was a post that said the other current city council member running for mayor had, you know, an action plan or something if he won, and the action plan included, like, step one, hire a new police chief.
Tim Burgess.
And that went within like 10 minutes. It was very interesting in the timing. I mean, usually you let a guy have his announcement, you know, pictures, all that good stuff. And then if you have something you want to say, maybe you take the next day.
Bruce Harrell took issue with that, coming out and saying, I'm going to fire this police chief. So already they have something to fight over.
And what you're seeing, I think, is Burgess and Harrell tangling for who's got the most cred in terms of being smart on law enforcement and law enforcement reform. Remember, Burgess was head of the Public Safety Committee in the past. Now Harrell is the head of the Public Safety Committee. If police reform is a big issue in the mayoral race, which it probably will be, the head of the Public Safety Committee, or whoever becomes most associated with that in the minds of the public, will probably have some juice going into the race. But so Burgess doesn't want that to be Harrell. Harrell obviously doesn't want that to be.
And don't forget, Burgess is a former cop. And so they are going to play that game with one another for sure.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
There's also interesting, you can see that the competition for, parts of Mike McGinn's base is going to be intense. The South End is getting a lot of focus. I mean, you've got Harrell in the race. You have McGinn making his announcement down at the Filipino Center in the Rainier Valley. Steinbrück has a lot of connections down in that part. So, you know, we've seen that the South End has been a tipper in a couple of mayoral elections in terms of, so, you know, that's where Nichols was able to overcome Sidran, for example. And I think McGinn edged Malahan.
Yeah, but you'll remember, and I think I mentioned this before the primary, the joke about McGinn was he'd never been south of the Ship Canal. He got right on that and opened this office down by Othello. And so now, you know, he's really worked that neighborhood.
He has. He's been a real presence down there. And I think that's interesting. And so then you sort of say, well, if, you know, you don't know how that vote is going to divide. I mean, it never divides equally among the, you know, 10 candidates or however they end up. The people will coalesce around a couple of different candidates. But it's interesting. So then is the fight for voters over the north of the Ship Canal vote? You know, does it become the fight for Magnolia?
Viva Greenwood, right?
Well, I know that this is important for people's careers, but is this a critical election? Does this feel like this is one of those vision elections that will decide the where the city's going in the next decade?
Any person can put their marker in and say, this is a big moment for our city. And if you're running and you want people to think you're the leader of that big moment, you say that.
Yeah.
And we say that about, this is the most important presidential election of our lifetimes. This is the most important gubernatorial
election. But we recognize the hyperbole of that.
There is some hyperbole of that because it helps the story to go back to the
right. Well, I know that's where we are.
Part of this discussion.
But does it feel, I mean, what do you all think overall?
I don't think it's the most important mayoral election of our lifetimes, but it's consequential. I mean, it is consequential in the sense that, you know, if you look at growth, if you look at how the city is urbanized, how it's shaped, these things are going to be happening at a faster pace. If you look at the number of huge projects that are underway and how those the amount we're spending is unprecedented. If you look at 520 and the waterfront and the tunnel and the Mercer mess, and I mean, if you add up all the dollars we're spending and not to mention new trolley lines and everything, it's very consequential in terms of what we're actually doing. And whether all of that stuff connects and integrates and works as it's intended. Now, it's going to take a larger time frame than one mayoral term for that to play out. But I think it's very consequential that way. I think the vision part of this election, I hope that becomes central, because I do think it will be the place where you can begin to distinguish these people from one another in terms of what their leadership abilities are to to actualize a particular vision that I hope they'll be able to articulate. I think McGinn does a pretty good job of that. I thought I listened to him on your show earlier in the week, and I thought he kind of lost his defensive tone and was doing a very good job of kind of explaining how all of his stuff fits together. And I think the other candidates are going to need to do that same that same kind of thing to compete with that.
Well, one question I have for everybody is this. So folks in their second term are so interesting and different sometimes from how they are in the first term. Obama might be an example of that. Do you think
he's lonelier?
He's lonely. We've established that. But do you think a first-term Obama would do on gun control what the second-term one is? He's not worried about reelection. He's coming out. He's going to take on the assault weapons ban. That is a good way to – I mean, the polls show more support for that from the public. But the NRA, you know, that is – they play tough. So I'm just wondering –
they're armed.
They're armed. I'm just wondering what, how the voters will factor in the idea of. So we got to know McGinn there at the beginning. What would he be like in a second term? That is that pretty much has to be part of the equation, don't you think?
Well, and I think that the voter calculation will be: we got to know McGinn at the beginning. What do we think of him now at the end? Because he's had quite an evolution, and I think an evolution in a lot of people's minds, and his ability to make an argument that says this is where we got under my first term and this is where we're going to get under our next term and we need to continue with this will, be a huge part of whether he succeeds or not. And to your question of whether these elections are important, I think they are all very important. And I do think this is a very important election for the reasons that Skip was outlining. I mean, there are lots of different directions to go on transportation, on light rail, on the bicycle master plan, on police reform. And that's just to name a few off the top of my head. And so the next mayor is going to, in addition to that, bringing us out of the recession. You know, McGinn guided us through some really rough years, and hopefully they're about to end. And what are we going to do when our civic pockets are a little more flush, or filled? All of that will be very, very important. And the question of whether you want to continue with the vision that McGinn has laid out or whether one of these other visions is more attractive will be, I think it's an essential one for everyone to consider in the city.
So here's another one on that note. And you wrote about this. So the other huge story this week is the Dreamliner and right. The 787s being grounded and the problems still being investigated. You asked the question, is Boeing's Dreamliner turning into a nightmare? I mean, at this point, it's too soon, but it does surely impacting the stock, and it impacts you, sort of your faith, the story that the company tells us.
Do you want to get on one? I think a lot of people have faith that Boeing will figure out what the problems are and find ways to solve them. The process, the Dreamliner is like a huge stake in it. And Boeing has done this before in years past when it's kind of bet the company on a plane, did that with a 747, for example. But so they did, but it was a different Boeing that bet on this plane. And there have been a lot of things that have been sobering about it. The plane is late, years late, beyond what they expected. It's had a lot of problems before approval, and having to shim the wings and make all kinds of adjustments. There's the whole issue of the way in which Boeing as a company decided to change its corporate culture. Part of that's the McDonnell Douglas influence. Part of it's the way they've consciously gone about trying to take it from the sort of old paternal engineer-driven Boeing to a company that outsources its engineering. I mean, not just a lot of the product making, but a lot of the design was outsourced to different people. And also there's that aspect of the stake in which Boeing has said, if you want us to build this plane here or assemble this plane here, you better give us X, Y, and Z. The way the public here has been, strong-armed really into providing subsidies and tax breaks and whatnot in order to make this plane possible. So they may just have, well, they have an engineering problem. They have a problem with the batteries they have to solve. Everyone, I think, agrees that's a major problem. The planes are grounded. That hasn't happened in decades. That's a big problem, and they have to figure out what that battery problem is. You also have the thing of, what, you know, how many problems do you get to the point where you're, you know, the new Edsel, where you're, regardless of how you re-engineer, do you end up with a product that is flawed in the minds of your customers?
And what about, remember the interactive map that showed where all the parts were made around the world?
Yeah.
That was always, that, at first that was kind of like, wow, you know, we are such an interconnected world. And then there were the questions that followed. How do you fit all those pieces if they're coming from so many different places? So,
yeah,
it's part of the story, I guess.
I've just been very interested in these batteries. I mean, I think all of the problems that Knut and Joni identified are interesting, but I'm sort of geeking out on these lithium-ion batteries, which, you know, in smaller forms are what powers our smartphones.
Yeah, they're in our pockets.
Right. Oops. And so this is a leap, this is a leap in technology that has been very consequential in our culture already, and that Boeing was trying to be not exactly even ahead of the curve on, but just on the curve, you know, instead of going with the older kind of car battery style batteries, they embrace these lithium ion batteries, which have a really impressive power to weight ratio, but also get really hot. And a lithium battery fire is a difficult thing to put out. And they knew this. Anyone who works with these batteries knows that. And so, you know, the kind of double-edged sword of embracing the latest in technology and then having it come back to bite you in a kind of literally, not exactly explosive, but flammable, combustible.
Smoking
way.
Well, it is. Yeah, you're right. It's fascinating on that. All right, one more topic real quick before we're over, since we touched on it. President Obama talking about gun control.
While there is no law or set of laws that can prevent every senseless act of violence completely, no piece of legislation that will prevent every tragedy, every act of evil. If there is even one thing we can do to reduce this violence, if there's even one life that can be saved, then we've got an obligation to try.
I want to ask you about something that you touched on in terms of the effort, and that was the NRA's response, the ad that they ran about you know, he wants to protect his children, but he doesn't want to protect yours. You said they played hardball, and there was a little example of how they're going to reframe and recast.
They've had a rough couple of weeks on the PR front, because that ad definitely generated some very strong reaction. You can disagree on policy all day, but a lot of people feel you don't mention. And Chris Christie got in this. He is loving being the sort of bad child of the Republican Party. He just another press conference the Republicans must go. What's he going to do to us now? But he among many others commented on the fact that you don't mention the other person's kids, and also the unique situation of those kids as they go to school. You know, different levels of protection. Yes, probably true.
Yeah, it was disgusting and just illogical. It doesn't. Their argument makes no sense. Are they suggesting it just makes absolutely no sense? Of course, the president's family needs some amount of security. And when you actually look at it, the school that they go to, the president's kids, has actually had a very hard time incorporating presidential security, or at least a lot of discussion, because they don't believe in armed guards at their school. But anyway, it was just disgusting and stupid, honestly. It was a really, really specious argument, and one they seem to sort of back away from.
Is the ad still running?
I don't think so, but as you mentioned, they are powerful. They're a powerful
group.
Well,
it is interesting, though. I mean, the more they talk, the more, yeah, I mean, they better hope there isn't a mental health database, because some of the leadership of the NRA would end up in it.
Boom! You know? All right. We'll go out on that laugh line.
All right.
Knut Berger is the Mossback at Crosscut.com. Eli Sanders, associate editor at The Stranger. Joni Balter, assistant political editor at The Seattle Times. You guys have an excellent week. It's going to be cold, so we're going to leave you with our sound of the week, the cold weather bringing ice to Lake Taps. And weekday listener Andrea on a narrow channel, so she took her kids, they threw rocks on the ice, and this is the sound it made as they skipped and slid across the ice. Have a good week.
Ray Nagin, the former mayor of New Orleans, has been indicted on 21 corruption charges, including wire fraud, bribery, and money laundering. A full update in the news in a minute. KUOW-FM Seattle, KUOW-Tumwater, KQOW-Bellingham, and Digital HD Services.
Support for KUOW comes from WIM WIM, Seattle's new contemporary dance company led by Olivier Wevers, presenting Crave More, four dance premieres at Seattle Center Playhouse, January 18th to 20th. Tickets and information at wimwim.org.
Speaking of President Obama, which we just were a moment ago, what do you want President Obama to do in his second term? KUOW's Ross Reynolds will be taking calls and emails on that today during the noon hour. If you can't wait to share your thoughts, you can call our feedback line right now, 206-221-3663, 206-221-3663. Thanks for listening. The program you just heard was made possible by the financial support of our listeners. Support this program and others like it by making a pledge today at KUOW.org.